We're nearing the end of our summer series on King David, the man that the Bible calls a man after God's own heart. But today we find that David's fervent love of God, the love that had propelled him from the sheepfolds of Bethlehem all the way to the royal palace of Jerusalem, had somewhere along the way become cool and distant. And now David's kingdom was in crisis. And it turns out that the greatest threat of David's lifetime doesn't come from any outside enemy like the Philistines with their Goliaths, nor does it come from a rival clan like the house of Saul, always a thorn in David's side. But it comes from within David's own tribe, from within his own family. As it turned out, David and his kingdom were nearly undone by his own son. You know, the tragic story of David's handsome and charming son, Absalom, is the centerpiece of the book of 2 Samuel. It takes a full 7 chapters to tell, and we just heard a little bit of it in our reading this morning. And it's in the midst of this greatest crisis of David's life that a king who had become complacent and apathetic rediscovers his focus and his feelings and his faith. The long years of David's reign are mostly left untold in the Bible, except for a few key events here and there. To borrow somebody else's phrase, this is the big, boring middle of David's life. The brave young man who boldly stood up to the giant Goliath is really now a distant memory. Even the vigorous young warrior who time and again outwitted King Saul and eluded capture in the wilderness has faded into the past. This middle-aged David, his hair showing touches of gray, lets his army go off and fight his wars for him while he stays behind in his comfortable palace. Secure and self-satisfied, David sits idly by while his kingdom seemingly runs itself. Coasting through life, this David is either blindly oblivious or shockingly indifferent as the fabric of his family life begins to unravel. The tale begins in 2 Samuel 13, where we're introduced for the first time to 3 of David's children, all of whom are destined for tragedy. Amnon is his firstborn, his heir apparent, the presumptive future king of Israel. While Absalom, whose name ironically brings together the words for peace and father, is the charismatic son of an Aramean princess. Absalom's sister is Tamar, a young woman of remarkable beauty. But this picture-perfect family portrait is soon spoiled by a truly horrific incident. Amnon, much like his father in the previous story about which we heard last week, becomes obsessed with a woman he can't touch. In this case, his half-sister, Tamar. He conspires with a friend to lure her to his house, overpowers her, and then throws her out, violated and disgraced. The incident quickly becomes public knowledge, and though the king is furious, nothing speaks louder than his inaction. His daughter has just been violently assaulted by his oldest son, but David fails to respond. But for Absalom, his sister's honor cries out for justice. This was not something that could be ignored or quietly swept under a rug and forgotten. If the king would not act, then it fell to Absalom to take matters into his own hands. For 2 years, he bided his time, waiting for the right opportunity, until finally, at a sheep-shearing festival where all the king's sons were present and the wine was flowing freely, Absalom had his brother ambushed and killed to avenge his sister. The remaining princes quickly fled for their lives while Absalom hightailed it out of the country, taking refuge with his mother's family in the kingdom of Geshur across the Jordan. Absalom's exile lasted for 3 years, but his estrangement from his father dragged on far longer. The Bible tells us that once David was consoled concerning Amnon's death, he longed to go see Absalom. But he kept those feelings to himself. Even after Absalom was allowed to return to Jerusalem, the king continued to refuse to see him. Another 2 years went by. Finally, Absalom had had enough. His demands for an audience with the king were granted, but David's reception was cold and formal. Their relationship that of a king and his subject, rather than of a father and his son. So the seeds of Absalom's rebellion were planted as David continued to put off reconciliation. It's almost shocking how oblivious David seems to have been to the events taking place right under his nose. When Amnon had sought to lure his sister into his house, it was the king who had blindly agreed to send her there. When Absalom urged his father to have Amnon attend the feast at which he planned to have him murdered, sure, it raised David's eyebrows, but he didn't press the issue. And as Absalom stole the hearts of the people, making overstated promises, growing ever more openly critical of his father's leadership, and charming the masses with his politician's smile. Did David fail to see, or did he refuse to see? When Absalom asked leave to go and fulfill a vow in Hebron, where David himself had once been crowned king, shouldn't he have understood his son's intentions? What follow are some of the most critical and humiliating moments of David's life. David had lost the popular support of his kingdom. Absalom leads a coalition representative of all the tribes of Israel, but backed most strongly by members of David's own clan. Those who remain most loyal to the king are largely mercenaries and foreigners. Fleeing the royal city, David is mocked and pelted with stones by his political enemies. And when Absalom takes possession of Jerusalem and the royal palace, his first act is to make a public display of his royal power by seizing his father's harem. David is at last reaping what he had sown when he took another man's wife and had him killed to cover it up. The Lord had told him, "You did this in secret. But now in broad daylight, out of your own household, I'm going to bring calamity on you. The sword will never depart from your house." Before it's all over, David will have paid a terrible price. And yet, what is perhaps most striking to me about this whole story is the way that the oblivious and apathetic king is transformed by this, the greatest crisis he's ever faced. When David is finally confronted with the reality of Absalom's rebellion, the young warrior who trusted God to defend him against kings and giants reappears. It's only when his son forces him to flee that David wakes up and rediscovers his focus and his feelings and his faith. See, for the first time, David is focused and ready to lead. As soon as the messenger arrives from Hebron reporting that the hearts of the people are with Absalom, David springs to action in a way that we haven't seen in chapters. He initiates an evacuation of the city, making for the safety of the Jordan River. And along the way, he makes several key strategic moves, organizing his fighting men and leaving loyal followers behind in crucial positions to feed him information and to mislead Absalom. It's been so long as we've been reading through 2 Samuel since we've seen David really acting like a king. And it's only now that the crown has been taken from him that he seems ready again to wear it. Times of crisis often have a way of bringing what's really important into focus, don't they? Important relationships and responsibilities long relegated to the back burner can take on a renewed sense of urgency in the face of trouble or uncertainty. An unexpected diagnosis can bring a family closer together. The loss of a job can open up questions like, what am I really meant to do with my life? Declining health can force us to make tough decisions about how we spend our increasingly limited time and energy. Times of crisis often help us to appreciate what's really important, rediscover our sense of focus as it did for David. Now, David also reconnected with his feelings as he faced down the threat of Absalom's rebellion. As David's losses had mounted and the danger to his family and kingship grew, we have watched him become increasingly stoic and unfeeling. Hearing of what happened between his daughter and his oldest son, the king was furious. But he buried those feelings so deep that he was paralyzed by indecision. He longed to go to Absalom in exile, longed to see his son when he returned to Jerusalem. But he hid behind his palace walls, steeling himself against the turbulent and conflicted emotions in his father's heart. The David who finally received Absalom after 5 long years had become so numb that his official kiss of pardon was as cold as ice. But the David who flees Jerusalem, trudging barefoot up the Mount of Olives as Absalom occupies the city behind him, weeps as he goes. His misguided attempt at a stoic acceptance of his misfortunes collapses under the weight of his son's betrayal. And when the uprising ends with Absalom's death, David, the father, is completely undone. Physically shaken at the news, he retreats into a private room, crying out, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." This moment is as pained as we ever see David. But for the first time in years, he's remembered how to grieve. Apart from allowing ourselves an authentic experience of grief, we can only bury our losses in numbness. Apart from acknowledging our hurt and anger about the wrongs we've experienced, we can only become entrenched in bitterness. Apart from truly lamenting the times it feels like the rug's been pulled out from under us, we'll never really be at peace. Welcome or not, our feelings come with us through any crisis. To ignore them just invites further trouble, as it did for David. But embracing our emotions, whether they're positive or negative, can begin to bring healing. So David has rediscovered his focus and his feelings. Finally, when David was forced to abandon Jerusalem and flee from Absalom, he rediscovered his faith as well. Up until the time of his son's insurrection, David's relationship with the Lord is notably absent from this story. But on the road down to the Jordan, David turns again to prayer. Only once in the whole account from Amnon's assault of Tamar until Absalom declares himself king, this is a period of at least 7 years, only once does David so much as mention the Lord. And that's only in an oath. That is to say, it has about the same religious content as swearing on a Bible in a courtroom. But as he flees from Jerusalem, David invokes the name of the Lord at least 6 times as he resolves to leave his fate in God's hands. At the foot of the same mountain where his descendant Jesus would one day pray, "Not my will, but yours be done," David is able to declare, "If I find favor in the Lord's eyes, he will bring me back again. But if he says, 'I'm not pleased with you,' then I'm ready. Let him do whatever seems good to him." A little further down the road, refusing to lash out against a man cursing and pelting him with stones, David says, "Let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. It may be that the Lord will look upon my misery and restore to me his covenant blessing instead of curse this day." As he faces tragedy and humiliation, David turns to God and finds that he's able to trust in the Lord for his future. How many have found the times of crisis and trouble, grief and sorrow have served to push us closer to God? How many have held all the more tightly to faith when there was nothing else left to hold on to? How many have found that God is a refuge, a shelter in the midst of the storm, a shield and a solid rock when even the very earth under your feet seems to give way? In Absalom's rebellion, David faced the greatest threat, not just to his reign, but to his life. But it was in the midst of this crisis that a king who had become complacent and indifferent, not just in his kingdom, but in his relationship with the Lord, found his way back by rediscovering his focus, his feelings, and his faith.